On this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Like, here are my goals. Tell me what to do, right? Take whatever test you need to take and throw it through whatever machine or whatever combination of that machine you need. But then tell me what I should do to achieve my goals.
You know, what it is you're excited about, what you kind of think the future will look like about the fitness industry as a whole from your perspective as an investor or somebody who's involved with it on a personal level.
I have a vision of how it should evolve, but I'm looking for an entrepreneur who wants to do all the hard work where I can just give them the capital.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You can put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life, you don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong, it's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. Just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry. Throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. All right, folks, my guest on today's show is Keith Raboy. Now, if you're involved in the financial industry in any way whatsoever, you're probably familiar with this guy. He's an entrepreneurial executive. He's an investor. He's been instrumental in multiple startups since the early 2000s. He's provided seed capital to companies like Airbnb and Lyft and YouTube and Wish and Yammer. And he also co-founded Open Door, which is a home selling startup, and has led investments for DoorDash, for Stripe, for ThoughtSpot, for Affirm, for Even Financial, for Piazza. And he's a former PayPal exec as well. But he's also, and this is something that perhaps flies under the radar just a little bit, pretty keen on things like fitness and sleep and heart rate tracking and personal optimization, to the extent that I thought he would be a great guest to have on today's show, because it's often quite interesting, for me at least, to hear how guys who are super successful from a business and a financial standpoint, but also happen to be healthy and fit, managed to pull that off. And it's always interesting when I get somebody like Keith on the show, because, you know, you go from the white coat wearing lab scientist in some exercise physiology lab to the actual person out there, you know, managing a job, juggling a lot of tasks, and still being able to optimize their body and brain. So as you hear Keith and I chat today, if you want to access the show notes for anything we talk about, any resources, anything like that, you're going to be able to find him over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Keith. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/K-E-I-T-H. Keith, welcome to the show, man.
Pleasure to be with you.
Yeah. I'm happy to have you on. And like I mentioned, you know, I've heard you actually in multiple podcast interviews, because I actually like to listen to some podcasts about investing and in business. I've heard you discuss how you do have a pretty intense interest in health and longevity and fitness. And I'm just curious if you've always kind of been into caring for your body, or is that a habit that you've developed of late?
I've always been pretty convinced that there's a strong connection between how your brain performs, how healthy your body is, and that there's not two different worlds, that you don't just be, you can't be successful in thinking if your body isn't healthy and fit. And in, like, you know, obvious example to start with, baseline fundamentals, rudimentary basic principles, is you need sleep. You need sleep to be healthy, and you need sleep to perform mental tasks. But in fact, there's more connection between your fitness level and your heart rate and your ability to think and be creative and be decisive. And so I've always connected all of these things together in my life and tried to integrate them and made them a priority. So I don't think I'm trading off work in technology and investing and entrepreneurialism versus health and fitness. I think they're symbiotic, and I try to maximize my performance just like an athlete would. Just the way I deploy my sort of skills is slightly different and measured by different metrics than an athlete would, but that the training program, the regimen, the thinking behind it is very, very similar. Just like the best athletes, they're pretty optimized on their athletic performance, but some of the delta is in their mental performance, their mental ability.
Yeah.
Those also, that translates back into my world, my professional world. But so, yes, I've been getting 8 hours sleep, for example, for all of my life.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk a little bit about sleep. You mentioned there that heart rate is something that you actually take into account. And, you know, you hear people talk about cardiovascular health, for example, and, you know, blood pressure and things along those lines. But getting into the nitty gritty, when you say heart rate, what exactly do you mean by that? What are you doing with heart rate, or I suppose with, if you also are alluding to this, something like heart rate variability?
So I measure three things associated with heart rate. I have a resting heart rate, 2-minute recovery, and an HRV variability. So they're all used somewhat for different purposes. Resting heart rate is a pretty good measure of overall health. It's not perfect, but it's a pretty good proxy. I was reading research last week, in fact, that it might predict your likelihood of suffering from cancer. HRV, I use differently. I use HRV as a way of measuring whether I'm overtraining or recovering enough. So I like to train twice a day, but there'll be times when my HRV is lower than normal and I might back off the intensity of my training until my HRV is in a more normal zone. So I use that as a, you know, sort of a proxy for how much recovery and rest am I getting against how much exertion and stress is in my life. And then the best single metric I use that I actually optimize my training for is what's known as a 2-minute recovery, which is basically just means exactly what it sounds like, which is you take your body to as intense an exercise as you can tolerate, and then you stop. Mm-hmm. And then you see how fast and how strongly your heart rate recovers after 2 minutes. And if you knew nothing else about somebody but what their 2-minute recovery was, you could predict a lot about their health, not just their fitness.
Yeah, I remember taking the 2-minute heart rate recovery test way back in exercise physiology classes, you know, as a metric of how quickly the heart is able to actually recover post-exercise. Have you found meaningful methods to actually reduce the amount of time that takes the heart rate to recover after bringing yourself to maximum exertion?
Oh, absolutely. So most of my training is focused around increasing my 2-minute recovery and improving it, which is basically increasing the delta. And so high intensity interval training is probably the best way to do it. Hill incline running, for example, some sports are pretty good. Start and stop sports where your sprint, stop, start, sprint, stop. So soccer, for example, can be a pretty good way to train. But I actually prefer like these kind of high intensity training programs now. Think like a Barry's bootcamp style workout. And I found significant success by using those programs to improve it.
I actually I've never taken a Barry's boot camp, but you know I totally get the concept of high intensity interval training with interval, of course, being the key for the heart rate recovery because you are pushing hard and then allowing the heart rate to recover and then pushing hard again. I personally do that typically 3 or 4 times a week using either the hell bike out in my garage, that Aerodyne bike with the arms and the legs, or this machine called a Vasper, which it's similar to a full body exercise machine, but it has blood flow restriction cuffs on it. So there's a little bit an added variable there. It circulates icy cold water through these blood flow restriction cuffs. And it's a spendy little exercise. I think it's like a $70,000 cardio unit, but in terms of high intensity interval training, it's kind of next level. But this idea behind the amount of time that it takes the heart rate to recover in between these intervals, and then the tracking of the resting heart rate. I'm curious if you've actually found that as your 2-minute recovery time improves, if you've seen that your resting heart rate also drops accordingly, or your HRV increases.
I think there is a correlation. I have noticed correlations in both of those over the years. Probably not a strict one-to-one mapping, but overall, as I've improved my 2-minute recovery, my resting heart rate has dropped and my HRV has tended to improve.
Now, what would a typical workout look like for you? Like if you were going to do specifically a cardio workout designed to enhance 2-minute recovery or some flavor of interval training, whether you want to describe what you're doing in a Barry's boot camp or what you might be doing on your own, what would a typical workout actually be for you?
Sure. A typical workout is about 50 minutes and it's probably subdivided roughly half into cardio and roughly half into resistance training, typically with weights. And I'd swap back and forth every 6 to 10 minutes between the two. So imagine 2 or 3 sets of each. The cardio component would typically be a mix of jog, run, sprint. So bring the heart rate up max, bring it back down, not all the way, but to, you know, somewhere where you can breathe relatively normally, and then sprint back up. And then vary the incline. So try to do the same on a flat kind of ground surface. And you can obviously sprint faster typically, but then increase the incline and try to maintain as much of the speed. And then there's different cycles, like different patterns of up and down. You can vary it like 30 seconds, you know, 30 seconds at the highest intensity or 60 seconds at the highest intensity, I mean, or vice versa, and kind of rotate that around somewhat for mental variety. I'm not sure how much the physical training part really requires that, but up and synchronized to music. So I think music has proven to be very effective for improving performance. It also is very, you know, effective for improving emotional tolerance of intensity training, which is related. There's a lot of good studies. They're collected in a nice book written by Professor McDougall at Stanford called The Joy of Movement.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of the research on the effect of music, in particular kinds of music and athletic performance. So my workouts are always synchronized with like EDM style music.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of, by the way, high intensity repeat training instead of high intensity interval training? Like they call it HIIT versus HIIT, where you're only exercising for like 10 seconds or less. So the concept here is you would reduce the amount of lactic acid buildup, but still allow for enough intensity to give a little bit of a cardiovascular stimulus. So it would be like, you know, 10 seconds as hard as you can go while you're out in a long walk, say like, you know, every fifth telephone pole or something like that, and then total recovery, but for a much longer period of time than you do with HIIT. Have you ever messed around with something like that?
I've never done that. I've done more something, maybe a hybrid in between, is 20 seconds of intensity and 10 seconds recovery. That seems to work. I would worry about the 10 seconds, whether you can really bring your heart rate up. I'd like to bring my heart rate up to basically max. I know most people guide you to like 80% of max, but I like to bring it up like pretty damn close to max. And I don't know if in 10 seconds in most activities, if you could get anywhere, you might need closer to 20 seconds.
Yeah, that's the tricky part is because, you know, until you're up to like 20 and usually even closer to like 30 seconds, you're really not tapping into carbohydrate, right? You're just splitting phosphagens, like the creatine phosphagenic system. And once you get going for about 30 seconds or more, you're burning sugar. But as a byproduct of that, you're also producing lactic acid. And some of the champions of this HIIT versus the HIIT training, they're citing research that shows that you can get long-term degradation of the mitochondria and some heart scarring if you're doing repetitive efforts that are 30 seconds in duration or longer. Probably the guy that talks about this the most is a Russian kettlebell trainer named Pavel Zetzelin. And all of his training is based around like 10 seconds, quick, snappy kettlebell swings. And then you're just kind of like walking around for a minute or so, coming back and then doing those short, snappy kettlebell swings again. And I personally get the idea of being careful with excess high intensity interval training, you know, especially these intervals that last longer than about 20 seconds. But I think that doing a little bit of both to me seems to make sense, like hit that super high end, super powerful 10 seconds or less system. And then also work in a few workouts where you're going 30 seconds or longer. So you hit both systems really.
I guess it depends partially on what you're optimizing for. So if I were optimizing for performance, like think athletic performance, I think I would be more sympathetic to the 10 second training. I'm not sure as I'm as sympathetic for other purposes. I do agree, though, that there is some danger on the heart scarring. It's a very vigorous debate. I've actually been studying this a lot myself. I think it's unclear, too, whether it's the tests for like heart tissue scarring that are sensitive to high-intensity training, or, in fact, there's underlying like damage. That even alone is a big thing. I've actually interviewed 5 world-class cardiologists trying to get to the bottom of this, and they have very conflicting answers.
Yeah, the most recent one, it was actually really recent. It was in the Journal of Applied Physiology, and I think it was just in June, where they found that elite athletes had mitochondrial impairment from their intense workouts. But these were folks, you know, who were doing, you know, we're talking like, you know, Ironman triathlon, 20 plus hour per week level with multiple HIIT sessions per week. Whereas a lot of the research that I've seen on heart health with more moderate amounts of HIIT, you know, like a couple of Tabata sessions a week, or, you know, a couple of HIIT sessions per week that are maybe, you know, 15 to 30 minutes in duration, those seem reasonable and even beneficial for cardiovascular health. Whereas I think it's the excess HIIT that develops the problem with not only potential for mitochondrial degradation, but then some of the, like the, I don't know if you've ever gotten like a calcium scan score.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm referring to. Is there's a lot of evidence that elite athletes score high on a calcium score, which is not what you want. It's actually, you know, normally quite scary. However, there's also some research that says it's actually not, it, although your calcium score is high, it isn't increasing your chance of a, you know, a heart event.
Yeah.
And that's what I've actually been debating with all these cardiologists.
No, you're actually right, because I got a calcium scan score in LA last year. I went down there and I wanted to do a story on what could a middle-aged man do when it comes to every last test known to science to find out the health of your ticker, you know, like a flow scan score and a resting EKG and an exercise EKG, et cetera. And a calcium scan was part of that. And the doctors were a little concerned because I think my score was around 35 or 40. And then upon further digging, what I found out was that athletes who have high calcium, it tends to be like this really small, dense, tightly packed calcium that is not the type of calcification that produces the same amount of heart disease risk as someone who has developed calcification due to, let's say, you know, chronic inflammation or a poor diet or excess sugar or vegetable oil consumption or something like that. So it appears to be the patterning of the calcification being different in athletes and being an issue that, despite a high calcium scan score, doesn't really make you as prone to cardiovascular disease.
No, I had the same issue. I actually did get an initial screen on a calcium score that was high, then was alerted to this research and, you know, given my propensity to do this training, at least half of my cardiologists are convinced that you're right. The other half still are a little bit more traditional and believe that any calcium score that's elevated is, you know, a signal of significant risk for a primary cardio event. But in any event, I think the more research that's being developed suggests your version is more correct, but this is all, like, you know, being developed in real time. One thing I do though, back to the training, you know, where is the line? I definitely measure the total minutes per week that are in each zone. And, you know, I maybe go close to the line of what's recommended, but I typically will only be in the max heart rate zone over an entire week for somewhere between 60 and 90 minutes. So that's not, maybe yeah, not ideal, maybe a little bit too high, but it's definitely not, you know, at the, you know, crazy level where you're taking on a significant incremental risk.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was James O'Keefe who was the exercise science researcher who came out with most of the data that shows really a ton of the risks in terms of exercise decreasing lifespan set in when you're exceeding on a daily basis, like an hour of moderate to high cardiovascular or 90 minutes of moderate cardiovascular exercise. And there's not a lot of people aside from, again, like some of the fringe Ironman triathletes and the people who are just hammering all day long who are getting anywhere close to that. So I think the dose is the poison in this case.
Yeah, the most I would do in a day that would qualify as in that range would be 40 minutes. So that would be like a pretty intense day.
Yeah. Yeah. And most people who can do high intensity interval training or think they're doing it for 60 plus minutes, like if you can do an hour of HIIT on a regular basis, you're a beast, because to, like, true high intensity interval training, those intervals are actually pretty tough. And most people who think they're doing HIIT are kind of like scratching the surface of how hard they should be going during the actual interval portion of the HIIT training.
No, absolutely. I was looking at my workout this morning, which wasn't that rigorous. I mean, it was on the easier scale, what I would do. And there's only 3 minutes in a peak cardio zone. It's 15 minutes in like a true cardio zone and 25 minutes in like, you know, a pretty lightweight zone, and then 4 minutes of warm up. So the distribution is very different than a lot of people's intuition.
What are you using to track? What's your wearable of choice?
So I wear an Apple Watch, partially because it's the easiest device to use for lots of purposes. I actually like the social features. I have a maxed out. I share my data with 40 friends and track back and forth. So it's the most social product. And then I output it into an app I call, that's called Zones, which is the easiest way to the best I've seen for visualization of the data.
Okay. Yeah. I haven't heard of Zones before. I'll have to look that one up. So when it comes to the other thing that you mentioned, in your introduction about a couple of things that you're into tracking, you also mentioned sleep. Are you using the same thing for tracking sleep, the Apple Watch?
I do not use the Apple Watch for tracking sleep, partially because I think it drains the battery. Secondly, it's also not very accurate. So if you're going to track your sleep, it's really critical that you can engage in accurate sleep stage discrimination. And any wrist-worn device is not going to be very accurate for discriminating REM sleep versus deep sleep. And so most of my life, I've been using old-school ZEO devices. Zio went bankrupt as a company like 9 or 10 years ago, but I've been able to scavenger hunt together a reasonable number of old Zio machines. But I've not found anything that's accurate enough for my tastes in Zio. However, at Founders Fund, we recently invested in a company that is developing a head-worn device that will be more accurate than Zio, that will correctly discriminate between deep sleep and REM sleep. Hmm. I do use also an 8 sleep mattress, which the major function of an 8 sleep mattress is it lowers your core body temperature using cooling, which induces more deep sleep. But there is HRV tracking and overall sleep tracking embedded in the mattress. And so I do triangulate some of that data.
Okay. I didn't realize 8 sleep was actually tracking that as well. You know, I use the chili pad, which yep. circulates the cold water under my sheet while I'm asleep. The thing that's kept me from using some of these more advanced mattresses and even some of the head worn wearables, you know, that'll measure, I think one that I looked into was Dream, that'll measure the yep. EEG signals, which, as you've alluded to, that can be a more accurate way of determining sleep stages than say like some of these wrist worn or finger worn monitors. You know, the thing that's given me a little bit of pause is this idea of nervous system recovery during sleep and the idea of being unplugged from an appreciable amount of like non-native EMF while you're asleep, you know, like Wi-Fi signals and Bluetooth yeah. and signals bouncing around the room. So do you consider any of that stuff when it comes to your sleep space?
I haven't. I'll have to investigate that more. I mean, I understand the logic or the concern, but I haven't studied whether the 8 hours when you're sleeping, it's critical to be completely divorced from that and how much damage you get from like an 8 sleep mattress measuring HRV or some head-worn device like Dream. The one I funded is not Dream, but I haven't really studied that too carefully.
Yeah, generally what I look at is whether or not something that is gathering data can be shifted into airplane mode during sleep, gather data during sleep, yeah. and then once you connect, like I wear an Oura Ring, for example, and I can just put yep. it into airplane mode. It'll collect data, then I can upload that data the next day. And I've noticed, because I had a what's called a building biologist come to my home and do a walkthrough, you know, with a meter of the areas of the house where there were larger amounts of, say, like, you know, radio tower signaling, cell phone signaling, non-native EMF, et cetera. And one of the places that he recommended I really focus on was the bedroom, again, because that's where a lot of the nervous system repair and recovery takes place during sleep. So if you can take that, you know, a third of your life approximately when you want to optimize repair and be unplugged, that it could be a prudent choice to do so. So I did that. And I actually did notice, you know, because I quantify a lot of this stuff too, a significant rise, like a 5 to 7 point rise in HRV during the night of sleep, which would technically indicate, you know, a good impact on the sympathetic, sure. parasympathetic balance. So I'm not this way everywhere, you know, like obviously my office is plugged in, we're talking on the internet right now. I use my phone, but when it comes to sleep, I just basically have this metric now where when I walk in, and I'll do the same thing in a hotel room now, you know, pretty much anything that can be unplugged or placed in airplane mode, I'll unplug or place in airplane mode. And I've found that to have a dramatic impact on sleep.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm going to have to test that out. That's a significant delta in HRV. Yeah. And maybe the 8 sleep can't really be put in airplane mode right now, but I suspect with product iteration, you know, it should be able, you know, some variant of that is definitely possible.
Yeah, and there's certainly ways to mitigate some of the damage. I mean, really, I think the main issue is, according to what I've looked into, the calcium influx that occurs in the cell in response to some of the electrochemical adjustments in response to this non-native EMF. So if you can do things like supplement with magnesium before bed, right, which yes. helps so to offset. Yeah, that helps to offset some of the calcium influx. I also do that when I fly on airplanes for the yep. same reason. And then two others that seem to have an impact on some of those functions that get affected by non-native EMF during sleep are ketones. Like, not, I mean, you could be in a state of ketosis, obviously, by adjusting, you know, the macronutrient composition of your dinner, or just like taking something like ketone salts or ketone esters prior to sleep. And that's another one that I've looked looked into and found to have a little bit of efficacy behind it. And then the last one is NAD, which is obviously a pretty popular anti-aging molecule these days. But the magnesium, the ketones, and the NAD seem to be the top three for mitigating some of those effects of non-native EMF, if you do have to be exposed to that during a night of sleep.
Well, that's great, because I actually naturally do two of those three things. So I have for many years done NAD supplementation, and then I'm a significant magnesium proponent as well. So I don't do the ketone stuff, but maybe I'm getting some of the benefits anyway, or some of the offsets.
Yeah, you probably are. And I want to ask you about your diet here in just a little bit. But what I thought would actually be interesting, and this will probably rabbit hole as we go along, is, you know, we talked about sleep and we talked about your workout flavor of choice. But I'm just curious, for you, what are some of your big wins when it comes to your own, you know, day in the life, as far as caring for your body and brain? If you want to maybe walk the listeners through what your morning routine might look like, or what some of the things you might be weaving into your day at work might look like, or even your evening routine, you know, and I might interrupt you a little bit as we go, but.
Yeah. The fundamental building block is starting with the 8 hours sleep. Right. So I reverse engineer that into my schedule, and just, I'm trying to go to bed as early as I can and as consistently as possible. So to be specific, say try to fall asleep around 10 PM. Might drag maybe by 30 minutes, but try to be as consistent as possible. And then I'll typically wake up, as you might expect, you know, somewhere around the 6:30, 7 a.m. zone. That leaves a little bit of a window where my body doesn't feel like it's stressed, that God forbid I wake up in the middle of the night, I'm not going to get 8 hours sleep. So I like having a buffer. Typically don't have to set an alarm clock, which is also a good metric for, first, are you getting enough sleep? And then B, it seems, for me at least, and I don't know if there's research on this, causes less of difficulty of falling asleep if I know I can just wake up at any time. Once I set an alarm clock, it causes like artificial stress, I think, in my brain.
Yeah, they've done research like that in medical students, where they found that when they know they're going to be woken up, you know, to, you know, like when they are when they're in the hospital or whatnot, and needing to catch up on a few hours of Z's before they're back, but they're on call, that sleep is disrupted. Even the mere fact of knowing that something is going to be waking you up actually disrupts sleep, which is super interesting, because an alarm clock technically fall into that category.
Yeah, well, it certainly has applied to my life. Like, I sleep poor sleep when I have to set an alarm clock.
Right, for like a flight or something.
Yeah, that flight is typically, it's very rare when I need to set an alarm clock, certainly averaging at most once a week. So I think that's allowed me to sleep better, but it also ensures that I'm getting the proper amount of sleep as well. So that's one technique. But then I wake up, and then I will typically immediately jump into a workout. So when I say immediately, like 30 minutes or so, you know, I'll have all these supplements that I'll consume, basically wake myself up. And then I will try to do an early morning workout of like a high intensity program. And that'll typically be the 50 minutes. Then I might relax, shower,
and you're doing that fasted, that workout in the morning.
I'm actually not doing it purely fasted. I know I should in many ways, but I feel I need, so it's more of a mental crutch, but I feel I need some energy. And so I will typically have a protein bar of like, a, you know, 20 grams of protein, 220 calories or something. Otherwise, I just feel mentally drained, and, you know, it's psychosomatic. Maybe it's not real that if I go into a high intensity workout without any, you know, supplement, without any food, I just feel weaker. I don't enjoy that feeling. It surely would be better for body composition, if nothing else, you know, to go into like a fasted state, but I've never found I can do it intentionally.
Yeah.
So I just basically, you know, give up on that. And then I'll have a little bit of a caffeine spike. These days I use like a Celsius drink to get that caffeine spike. If I have more time, I'll like prepare like iced green tea.
What's a Celsius drink?
It's a branded kind of combination. A lot of athletes are actually using it. It's becoming a fairly popular brand. It was pretty obscure a few years ago. You can find them in many places now. It's a combination of the active ingredient in green tea and mostly caffeine.
Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life, you don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong, it's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order.
The interesting thing about like those morning workouts that are fasted, you know, I kind of ran into the same issue myself. And then I started doing basically like a carb loading protocol, where I don't eat carbohydrates the whole day, right? So I'm in a state of fatty acid utilization, you know, burning ketones, vegetables, you know, healthy Mediterranean style fats, proteins throughout the day. And then at the very end of the day, I'll typically have anywhere from, you know, depending on the day's level of physical activity, 100 to 250 grams of carbohydrates, right? With dinner, with, you know, sweet potato, yam, rice, red wine, dark chocolate, what have you. And then I get up in the morning and do a fasted workout. And what I find is that as long as I've had carbohydrates the night before, typically kind of like you just alluded to, like the first 2 to 5 minutes of the workout, you feel a little bit flat because you don't have you know, the supplements in your system. Although I do some caffeine, like I'll do some black coffee or a little bit of tea or whatever prior to the workout. But aside from that, no actual calories. And what happens is when you begin the workout, the adrenaline and the norepinephrine and everything that gets released as you start working out, that causes your liver and your muscles to start to dump some of the glycogen that they stocked away from the previous evening's carbohydrate feeding. And so that bumps your blood glucose up rather than you getting the blood glucose elevated from, let's say, a drink or a pre-workout meal prior. And once I started doing that, I began to be able to just crush the morning workouts, but it takes that evening carb refeed. And then, you know, I'll do a 12 to 16 hour overnight intermittent fast, get up, work out, be able to burn those carbs from the night before and feel fine. But then if I restrict, you know, dinner, if I do, you know, what a lot of folks are doing now where they'll eat at like 4 PM and then, you know, to optimize sleep, not eat anything after that, you know, but for me, if I have like a 7 or 8 PM dinner with 100, 200 grams of carbs and I'm working out, you know, 8 AM the next morning, I feel great. So that's the flip that I switched to allow me to do the fasted morning workouts and still feel like I could push the envelope.
I haven't tried the carb loading before, you know, bed sort of thing or dinner. Maybe I'll try that a couple of days and just see how I feel. I do have this sensation often of the first 3 to 5 minutes being the most difficult. And then, you know, because of the adrenaline and all the other variables, I find, you know, for example, if I am a little sleep deprived or God forbid, I'm still hungover or something, the first 3 to 5 minutes are really painful. But if I can make it through that, or time travel, when I'm somewhat famous among my friends for landing in a new time zone and immediately going from the airport to a high intensity, you know, training program. And similarly, once the adrenaline kicks in, I can handle it, but man, the first 3 to 8 minutes are pretty brutal.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a suck fest. I find that much more so for a post-travel exercise routine than a early morning or morning exercise routine. I've kind of shifted just based on this whole concept of, you know, airline radiation and inflammation and disconnection from the surface of the planet, which is one reason why they've found, for example, astronauts to be just so physiologically effed up when they get back from space travel is actual disconnection from the electrical conductivity of the planet. What I now do after I travel is it's typically take the shoes off or wear one of those pairs of like earthing or grounding shoes that keep you connected to the earth. And typically for me now, it's either a long walk in the sunshine or if I can hunt down a body of water, that's amazing. Like if I can go for a swim post travel, I'll choose that 9 times out of 10 versus hitting the gym nowadays.
That makes sense. And certainly the natural sunlight is clearly, you know, outstanding. One of the benefits of living in Miami is I can find natural sunlight much more easily and much more consistently. I'm going to try the carb technique before dinner and then try a few days of not having a protein bar before my workout, because it clearly is better for body composition training to do that.
Oh yeah. I mean, like that's, I'll have a lot of people ask me about fat loss throughout the course of the year. And I think one of the best methods for fat loss is to wake up, do your morning workout in a fasted state, right? So you're tapping into your own fatty acids versus any fatty acids or calories that you've consumed from a pre-workout meal. And then I always finish with about 3 to 5 minutes of cold, right? Like cold shower, cold soak, cold jump in a lake, a river, ocean, or whatever I can find near a hotel or at my house. And the cold shifts your body into a huge state of fat burning simply because you're burning more calories to generate heat. And I do that almost 365 days a year, morning fasted workout, finish with cold. And specifically for body composition, it's just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, so I am a very big fan of cold plunge, 54 degrees, you know, 8 to 10 minutes, et cetera, post-workout. I don't currently do that enough, but I'm building into my house a cold plunge pool. That will allow me to do it every day. Unfortunately, the construction of it is taking much longer than it should with various permitting issues and engineering issues. But eventually, I will get it to every day. So I've only been able to do it kind of on an ad hoc basis, but I'm really looking forward.
You're getting one of those like cold plunge systems in your house?
Yeah. I've used it before for athletic training. You know, when I travel for specific kinds of training, I have some friends who have access to one. So I really enjoy it. I haven't done it consistently enough to see the fat loss benefits, but I feel the benefit the next day. So I can do a very vigorous, let's say legs workout, squats, deadlifts, lunges, everything. And if I can do a cold plunge, you know, sort of after the next day, I'm fresh, ready to run, ready to play soccer, basketball, with almost no impact from the day before's training. Whereas typically I would feel some lactic acid the day after a heavy squat day. And, you know, I can power through it mentally on a treadmill or in a high intensity exercise, but it probably has some performance attributes, you know, if I'm playing tennis, basketball, or soccer that I don't really enjoy, degradation there. Pretty excited about the cold plunge. Last year during COVID, I went to Iceland for like 10 days. And fortunately, we were living in a house that had a cold plunge in the backyard. So I was able to use it every day, and it felt great. I wasn't training aggressively enough to take advantage of all the benefits. One of the disadvantages of being in Iceland was I was deprived of my normal workout program, but the benefit was I was cold plunging every day.
It's kind of funny that you actually had to have a cold plunge in Iceland. Although, you know, in Miami, it makes better sense. I'm not going to rib you for saying that 54 degrees is cold, because that makes sense if you're a Floridian. I keep mine at about, I have one of these like done for you chiller system cold tubs. It's made by a company called Marazco, and it'll maintain like 32 degrees when it's 110 degrees outside. It's literally right outside my office. I can see it from here, and I'll go jump in that during the day. Sometimes a couple of times a day in the summer, it's like a full body cup of coffee, and it does have a lot of benefits. I think the only thing is that, and you may have come across this as well, is that research shows that, as you've already kind of experienced, like the drop in core temperature and the drop in post exercise muscle soreness even the next day is pretty profound, especially with cold water immersion, even more than like those cryotherapy chambers. There's some people though that still eschew that idea and avoid the cold plunge post workout because they've heard that it blunts the hormetic response to exercise, like it blunts mitochondrial adaptations or muscle growth. But I looked into the data on this, and you have to get the muscle core temp to drop by something. It's like 3+ degrees. And that takes a good 10+ minutes in pretty significant cold for that to happen. So if you're just like jumping in a cold bath for, you know, like I do, like 2 to 5 minutes after the workout, just to get the core temp down, you're fine. But I think the people who do themselves a disservice are the people who exercise and then get into the cold for like 10, 20 minutes. That's where you see a law of diminishing returns, or that's where you'd want to save the cold plunge for later in the day, like a few hours after the workout, after your body's kind of had a chance to mount its own endogenous antioxidant defense and kind of upregulate mitochondrial production, everything you'd look for after a workout. And then you do the cold later on in the day, but a quick cold soak post-workout, you're spot on. I mean, it's great for the next day's soreness and for being able to come back the next day, you know, just as fresh.
Yeah, I try to keep it in the zone of 8 to 10 minutes, maybe 12 minutes absolute max. I was taught, but I've never independently verified, that 54 degrees was like the ideal temperature for this, that you don't really need to go colder to get the benefits you're looking for.
Well, you're right. You're right in that most of the research has shown that to get the benefits of cold, you got to be at 55 or lower. But the reason I go 32 is it's a time hack, because they've also done a lot of comparisons of longer soaks at slightly elevated temperatures versus shorter soaks at very cold temperatures. And you get the same benefits from just a couple of minutes at 32 degrees as you would from 8 to 10 minutes at 55. So if I can give myself an extra 8 minutes every day by just going colder water and a shorter soak, you know, even though it's a little bit more of a suck fest, I like to do it that way. But really, you get the same benefits either way. It's just a matter of how much time you want to invest.
That makes sense. But I am definitely looking forward to, hopefully by January or so, I'll have this, you know, whole, maybe earlier, set up in my house, and I can take advantage of this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a pretty sweet setup. That'll be cool for you to have. One thing I didn't ask you as you were talking about your sleep was, like before you go to bed, are you taking any supplements to enhance sleep, or do you have any, like biohacks in the bedroom that you use to enhance your sleep besides that 8 sleep mattress?
Yeah. So I do have several things, and, none of it's like, well, very few components are like rocket science or anything radical, but you know, classic, like, ambient temperature is pretty cool in my bedroom, ideally 65, 64 degrees, blackout shades, sleep with an eye mask, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the basic stuff, consistent sleep. I try to eat dinner relatively early, not the 4 p.m., but for all intents and purposes, I really like to be eating closer to 7 than, you know, later. Not always possible. Certainly one disadvantage of Miami is people, like also in New York City, people eat out later.
Yeah.
But I will typically be on the earlier end of the spectrum. If I can eat at 6:37, I'm pretty happy, almost not really thrilled about eating past 8 p.m. Because I think it does, at the margin, impact my sleep. Second, I do take a supplement produced by a company called Thorn called Recovery Pro, which is a combination of supplements designed for recovering from training, but also sleep enhancement.
They recently discontinued Recovery Pro, I think. So I'm hoping you stocked up on it.
I think they remixed it
okay,
to a different formulation. But you can buy some of the active. They also sell some of the active ingredients separately as like a pill. This is like a cocktail you mix with water before bed. But in any event, I've been doing this for a few years. I think it's effective for me. Don't really know. I take magnesium supplements, as we discussed, on an ad hoc basis. So I have a jar sort of supplements near my bed. And if for whatever set of reasons I feel like I should take one, I'll just grab it. I also do use one drug that's been very effective for me called Rozerem, R-O-Z-E-R-E-M. That's designed for reducing issues with sleep onset. It's pretty magical. It's fairly underrated. Not that many people know about it, even though I think the profile of the drug is incredible. It has almost no side effects and is extremely effective.
And so it's not like a diazepam, like a Valium.
No, it has a very different impact. It's also allegedly non-addictive, but the good news and bad news is you can't use it on an ad hoc basis. You basically have to take it every day, but I found it to be incredibly effective for me in both avoiding sleep onset issues, which I used to suffer from, and time travel. So, but it is the kind of thing that you can't just use once a month.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. You know, I'm just looking it up right now. Okay. It's acting on a similar mechanism of action as melatonin. That's interesting.
Yes. So it's like, it feels like melatonin on steroids in some ways. It's not exact. That's a simplification, but directionally correct.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I use, especially when I travel, as kind of like a sledgehammer for sleep to realign the circadian rhythm, high dose melatonin. I actually have this doctor in Florida, and I get a melatonin suppositories from him because they kind of slowly release into the system while you sleep. But we're talking a lot. Like, it's like 200 to 300 milligrams of melatonin. One of the side effects of that is, of course, you're a little bit drowsy when you wake up. Yeah. And you know, for the same reason that avoidance of blue light at night is a good idea, because blue light suppresses melatonin, just getting blasted with sunlight as soon as you wake up, just that kind of banishes all the grogginess that you get from high dose melatonin prior to sleep. But that Rozerem doesn't leave you groggy at all in the morning?
No, I found it. I can't discern any difference between Rozerem induced sleep and natural sleep. Unlike with melatonin, which I almost never actually use anymore, having read Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker, I think the proper use of melatonin is for time travel and time adjustment, not for, you know, general sleep issues. I think it isn't effective for that, because it actually doesn't align the curves of sleep and circadian rhythm correctly. But for readjusting to a new time zone, it's effective. I do try to get 8 to 10 minutes of natural sunlight every morning. Ideally between 6 and 8 a.m., which is, you know, the best and most effective time. In Florida, it's actually pretty easy to do. In other, you know, obviously living in other places, it takes more of a conscious effort to do that. But I think I've never really found myself groggy in the morning unless I've taken extra supplements for, you know, some reason. The drug itself, Rozerem, doesn't induce it.
Right. That's interesting. Cool. I'll look into that one. And then so we got to your morning, you get that morning workout in with your pre-workout bar. And then are you also having breakfast at some point after your workout?
Depends on the day. So what I'll do is typically post my workout, I'll have like a traditional protein shake. And that's going to be kind of, you know, a mix of protein, yogurt, banana, something, you know, that type.
Mm-hmm.
That may be sufficient for me. I mean, you know, it's probably, you're probably talking 300 ish calories kind of size. In some mornings that may be enough, to, you know, kind of motivate me, through lunch. Some other mornings, depending on where I'm going next, what meetings I have, I may have a more traditional breakfast instead, like eggs, scrambled eggs, sometimes yogurt and granola. That's pretty variable. I'd say maybe 4 days a week, it's just protein shake and go to work. The other 3 days, it's more of a traditional breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah. And so if you decided to do that, that carbohydrate backloading or carbohydrate refeeding in the evening, then the only adjustment you'd need to make would be to, instead of having things like yogurt and or bananas or blueberries or other forms of carbohydrates in the morning smoothie, you'd shift it. So it's more like whatever, like nuts, seeds or nut butters or coconut milk or bone broth or stevia or like all fats and proteins, and then take all those carbohydrates you'd normally have in the morning and shift them into an evening scenario. That's the only issue with doing that carbohydrate feeding is, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it too. Right. So if you're going to save all the carbohydrates for the evening, you gotta decrease them for the breakfast and lunch feedings. But, and then that's what I do. I have a smoothie every morning at some point after my workout. Typically I wait around an hour or so, just because if you fast for a little while post-workout, you get a little bit of an increase in growth hormone and testosterone, but then I'll just put a bunch of ice and bone broth and stevia and salt and, you know, some coconut flakes and stuff like that, like all protein and fat based compounds in the blender, and have like almost, you know, some people would consider it to be almost like a ketogenic smoothie for my post-workout meal. And that allows me to save the carbs for the evening.
That makes sense. I mean, the one thing that I do differently is maybe there's more modern research on this. I still subscribe and adhere to the kind of the old school advice about having the protein smoothie within 20 minutes of finishing your workout.
So it's accurate, but like a lot of nutrition information, that's trickled down advice from the bodybuilding and the pro athlete sectors, because if you do not eat within about 20 to 60 minutes following your workout, if you don't do that kind of like recommended protein carb refeed, what happens is that if you are going to work out again within 8 hours, the glycogen and amino acid levels aren't fully replenished to the extent to where you could throw down a really good workout routine within 8 hours. But if you're not one of those people who's doing like a hard pro athlete or bodybuilder esque, you know, 2-a-day routine, I'm not talking about like, you know, a short workout in the morning and a sauna in the afternoon or something. I'm talking about like crushing it in the morning and then having scrimmage or practice or another, you know, just rip you wide open session later on in the day. What they've shown in research is that by eating ad libitum, just by eating your normal diet for the next 24 hours after your workout, by the time you get to the next morning's workout, everything's topped off just fine as it is, and your body's repaired properly and everything. So it kind of depends, you know, and for most folks, it's the pro athletes or the bodybuilders, et cetera, who need to worry about the prioritizing the timing of the post-workout meal, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes tons of sense. And so, yeah, I think the way I'd probably start applying that now is on days where I'm definitely going to do 2 vigorous workouts to maybe prioritize the timing. And then on days when I know I'm going to basically do 1 primary workout, yeah, just eat kind of my normal diet.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that'd be prudent. Okay, so you get your breakfast in. I'm assuming at some point, because you appear on paper to be a successful executive, you are actually working at some point.
Yeah, unfortunately, I do work. I do typically do a lot of meetings, probably call it somewhere between 6 and 10 meetings a day.
Now, when you're working, are you one of those like treadmill workstation, you know, Pomodoro breaks to swing kettlebells type of guys? Like, are you moving throughout the day?
No, none of that. I mean, partially by meetings in my work is really entails conversations with other people. And so I think that would be more distracting. And so even if I were convinced of the benefits, I don't know if it'd be a realistic option. I do think there are benefits of a standing desk, et cetera. I've experimented with those over the years, but I'm still meeting with a lot of people, one-on-one conversations, mm-hmm. one on, you know, conference rooms with five people, where that wouldn't really be very effective. I've read some recent research that was very intriguing about the benefits of trying to do work while you're on a treadmill. But I don't know if it'll translate that well to the kinds of things I need to do.
Yeah.
So I just basically am separating that part of my life. When I'm at work, focused, meeting with colleagues, my phone's away. I'm just dialed into listening to what they have to say, you know, helping them try to address and solve and prioritize their problems and challenges. And then, you know, as soon as I can escape that, I'll go back to, you know, being healthy and focused on my own stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the treadmill research is, it's mostly based on the idea, you know, and there was even the kind of like the ancient Greek practice of these walking universities where students would learn as they were wandering. You do get an upregulation of brain derived neurotrophic factor, which is kind of like Miracle-Gro for the brain. So if you're engaged in learning, like, let's say you're going to watch a documentary, or even maybe you're going to review like a video of a deck that somebody sent you or something like that, then there actually is something to be said for moving as you digest that, because you might be able to assimilate it better. But if it's more of like a complicated board meeting or discussion that's a little bit more involved, or something where you're not learning, but you're also producing information, sometimes it can be distracting. Like I'll sometimes do Zoom calls with my team and things like that on the treadmill, but because a great deal of my work involves writing and authoring and working on articles, I can't produce very great content while I'm moving, you know, for example, on a treadmill and doing those types of things.
No, that makes sense. Yeah. Unfortunately, there are times when I'm trying to assimilate and learn, and maybe I should be moving more, but I think I'm often, you know, I need to take notes, and need to be interacting. And I don't think the movement really works so well, or at least no one's created, you know, like a perfect product for that yet. But the research is pretty interesting and fascinating, and I was moderately unaware of it until recently.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you get through the work day, and then I think you mentioned early on in our discussion that you try to do two movement sessions in a day, or two kind of like workout-ish type of sessions.
So ideally, after finishing my work, I will go do a second high intensity training. So my ideal schedule is one in the morning and one late afternoon or the evening. So that's what I'm going to do today. For example, I worked out, my first program was 8:20 a.m. to 9:10, and then I'm going to do another program at 4:45. That's like ideal for me. Now, sometimes I have to batch them more tightly together, like logistically, often on a weekend, for example. Sometimes I'll actually do them back to back, which is mostly time efficient. So from a professional standpoint, it's great to be able to do back to back, you know, showering once, one protein shake, etc. But I think my body actually prefers the recovery, you know, for the 8 hours or 6 hours or 7 hours in between.
I agree. And that might be based on some of the nutrition information I was sharing with you earlier about this idea of nutrient replenishment needing a certain period of time, you know, to restore amino acid pools and for the nervous system to recover, et cetera. So that spacing of about 6 to 8 hours, that works very well for me also. You know, I'm typically working out sometime around 8 or 9. And then when I'm finishing up a lot of my work, typically around like 5 to 7 PM ish, that's when I'm returning for another session. Although for me, I'll save the more complex, like a lot of times I'll do something more cardio-ish or sauna or cold pool, et cetera, in the mornings. And then for the more complex activities, like let's say weight training, you know, your body temperature peaks, your reaction time peaks, your testosterone peaks, your grip strength peaks, all these things peak in the afternoon to early evening. So I'll do kind of like whatever the more complex routine of the day is, typically later on in the day, if I do have the luxury of time to do a two a day.
Yeah. And then I will do that too. So on days where I'm only doing one high intensity training program, then I will do strength training, and that'll be a quick session, but very heavy weight. So it's the complement to the stuff to the kind of activities that are difficult to do in a high intensity session. So I'll do 15 to 30 minutes of heavy backloaded squats, pull-ups, heavy dumbbell rows, et cetera.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So when you finish that afternoon or evening workout, you know, I didn't even ask you this, but are you actually eating anything between breakfast and that workout? Do you have a lunch break?
I do. Well, I don't have a lunch break, but I do have lunch. So I will typically
be sounds like me. Lunch equals a salad and replying to emails.
Yeah, I will either be working through a lunch meeting where I have food, but I'm consuming while I'm working. Or, you know, catching up on emails definitely over lunch. Or maybe I'll get like a you know, sort of 15-minute break and go grab a sandwich or something like that. But it's typically, you know, tightly compressed time and a more like a utilitarian meal.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you are basically working through lunch, you get to the end of the day, you throw down that workout. And then as you're kind of like going between the workout and dinner, anything else that you're doing in between that period of time to get yourself ready for your evening wind down routine?
Not really. You know, ideally I'll try to figure out find some time to either catch up on emails if I've been in meetings all day with other people, or if I have 15 to 30 minutes spare, I will read a book, like long form content. Sometimes I'll do that in the morning if I have extra time or excess time. Sometimes I'll take a nap. That depends on finding I'm pretty proficient at 20 minute naps, but I need to be in a place, an environment where I can easily find a bed that's comfortable. And that's not always possible. Like today, I may have time before my 4:45 to take a quick 20-minute nap, and I'll feel great. I'll have more energy in my brain. I'll be like much more alert if I can get a 20-minute nap in between.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Like I'm a huge napper, and I'm at the point now where I'll just curl under a desk or a conference table, you know, just wherever I happen to be. But I always in my work bag, I've got a really good sleep mask. I use one called the Mindfold, which is actually one that a lot of like plant medicine practitioners will use to completely block off light for a, you know, like a psilocybin ceremony or something like that. I found this mask and it just works fantastically. So I use this Mindfold mask, like over the ear noise blocking headphones. And then, I've got this app called, Nucalm. And it has like it's got a bunch of different options on it, but it has this 20 to 30 minute power nap function on it that'll just blast me off to the middle of nowhere. You know, even if there's a bunch of people talking in the room, and when I lay down with all that stuff on, and then typically I'll use at least one wearable that kind of lulls you off to sleep. Like there's one called the Apollo. It produces this micro vibration around your ankle, around your wrist, wherever you tend to wear it. And it will induce a brainwave response that actually is very relaxing. So I'll either put that on, or there's this newer device called a Hapbee. I don't know if you've heard of that one, but it uses like a magnetic signal to simulate. I mean, you could use it for wakefulness. Like it'll simulate theobromine or caffeine or nicotine, but then it'll also simulate like CBD or melatonin. Mm. If you've had too much caffeine prior to bed, it'll simulate adenosine. And so typically for my naps, I'll take about 3 minutes just hooking myself up to all that stuff. And then I can go dead to the world anywhere on the face of the planet, but it does take a little bit of better living through science to really be able to check out for a mid-afternoon nap.
Yeah. I've never been able to artificially nap. If I can get in a nice, comfortable bed with a cool temperature, I can have a really effective, you know, amazingly revitalizing nap. But if I have to try to find a way to sleep in some unusual environment, I just can't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it. Well, I it's kind of funny because when I interview like business execs or super successful people like you, always at the back of my mind during the interview, I'm thinking, oh, this is a busy and important person. They probably have a whole bunch of important things to rush off and go and do. And so I want to be respectful of your time. However, I would also be super remiss not to ask you, as a guy who's actually not only in the investment industry, but also keen on fitness, about what some of the things you are excited about in terms of the future of the fitness or the health optimization or the biohacking industry. You know, what it is you're excited about, what you kind of think the future will look like, whether it's like customization, personalization, you know, home workouts, you know, what are the type of things that get you excited about? If you could riff for a little bit about the fitness industry as a whole, from your perspective as an investor or somebody who's involved with it on a personal level.
Yeah. So we've invested in a couple of areas, improving sleep, enhancing sleep. I mentioned Eight Sleep, for example, but that's not the only one. Anything that would improve the quality of sleep, I think has massive benefits for health, fitness, basically happiness, it's probably the single best thing we could do for like human performance, is to increase quality of sleep. Second, we also like to invest in areas that can extend human lifespan. That's an area that I think is very raw, and we're just seeing the first generation of founders, entrepreneurs, and companies there. but obviously be very interested personally and professionally in that area. Home fitness, we have invested in. I think there's some benefits to investing in the home fitness world, but it's not clear to me yet when the world reverts back to normal, how much of that's durable, how much of that is just becomes part of a hybrid mix. So, you know, instead of going to the, let's say, a gym 5 days a week, I now go 3 days a week and then I do two workouts at home. I think there's some mixes of behaviors for people who are interested in stuff.
I guess that assumes that things will revert back to normal. Isn't there some like law of human psychology that dictates that once we introduce a law or a principle, like say like mask wearing or, you know, a little bit more difficulty in terms of the ability to be able to attend a class at a gym without jumping through a bunch of health safety hoops, that it just kind of stays that way? I forget the name of that law. And obviously this
I actually don't know where the residual, you know, kind of lands. But I suspect we wind up in some hybrid. So I'll use a Peloton bike once in a while, for example. I have one. If I need an extra cardio, you know, session without as much, you know, drain, I'll use that because it's very efficient. It's at home, usually not bringing me into the, you know, top cardio zone, but it's a nice cardio complement. I'll do stuff like that. We've invested in a company called Tempo, which has strength training based programming for home, for, you know, with the basically uses real resistance weights. We're looking for opportunities. I think the bigger area for innovation that maybe transcends all of these would be the personalization. So I think most of nutrition advice, maybe even most of health advice, suffers from a flaw of averages problem, that on an average population, X or Y or Z is good for you or bad for you, but that most people are not average and that the advice is therefore incorrect for them. I think this is what accounts for these conflicting studies that we see in the media. You know, bananas are good for you or they're bad for you. Eggs are good for you or bad for you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think the reason why is there's some subtle differences in the population that they were tested on, and that different people respond very differently.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's a huge amount of biochemical individuality. I mean, that's kind of like the whole magic of self-quantification and it becoming increasingly affordable. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, the ketogenic diet that helps one person can produce, you know, inflammation and increased risk for Alzheimer's and dementia and malabsorption of saturated fats and a whole bunch of issues in somebody else. So yeah, I mean, I see the same thing in that there's a huge need, preferably via a great deal of AI and automation, if possible, to develop more personalized exercise and health and nutrition and supplementation prescriptions based on self-quantified data. But it just seems like such a young industry, which actually surprises me. I thought we'd be farther ahead.
I would have too. Yeah, I would have guessed it would be further ahead. I think part of the reason why is no one's developed a great non-invasive way to personalize yet. So the stuff I've seen that is effective requires blood draws. And, you know, those are tolerable, but they're not tolerable every day necessarily, or not tolerable every day to kind of a mainstream productized sense. So I think as we can develop proxies that are accurate enough for personalization that don't require consistent blood draws or require at least micro drops of blood, then I think we can see some, you know, commercialization at scale of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and there are companies that are kind of sort of doing that. Like, you know, well, you brought up Thorne, right? Thorne has its home test kits now. There's another company called Base. There's a couple that are doing, you know, urine measurements like Vessel. But, you know, nobody has kind of like an all-encompassing solution now. And even those companies that I just named, the only recommendations that you're getting are what supplements to take or what dietary adjustments to make. And there's still no exercise or lifestyle or, say, like, you know, biohacking recommendations. Like they're still pretty niche when it comes to the universality of the recommendations.
No, and I think that's the problem is normal people, normal in quotes, require like a kind of want someone to guide them or something to guide them of like, here are my goals. Tell me what to do, right? Take whatever test you need to take and throw it through whatever machine or whatever, you know, combination of that and machine you need, but then tell me what I should do to achieve my goals and simplify it for me. Like, okay, eat this, don't eat that. Change your workout program from X to Y, more intense, less intense, you know, whatever the cases are. But right now you can only, if you know you have a specific concern or issue, you can find these tests or quantification techniques if isolated, but being isolated feedback without knowing the context of everything else you do in your life or whatever your goals are really isn't that helpful to most people.
Right, exactly. And that's the problem. Like your CRP is elevated. You're at high risk for heart disease. You need to go in for a workup and avoid high intensity exercise when in fact your CRP is elevated because you lifted weights the day before.
Exactly. There's all these dimensions. And like, you know, the canonical examples are the just simple glucose, you know, sensitivity and insulin spikes. There are people who can eat pizza with no insulin spike, and there's people who can eat chocolate chip cookies, and some people can eat bananas with no insulin spikes. But you need to know that for you. And it's very liberating if you happen to be one of the people who can, you know, consume your favorite foods without insulin spikes. But then you might be surprised that things that are otherwise healthy for other people that don't cause insulin spikes actually do affect your body, like apples or something. So being able to tune your diet, but that's only on one dimension.
Right. And even those recommendations, all they're looking at is the microbiome response to a food and how that would affect blood sugar levels or the insulinogenic, like the pancreatic response. But even those tests don't take into account the fact that in some people, like let's say almonds, which you wouldn't expect to spike your blood sugar at all if someone's allergic to them, right? You get a sympathetic nervous system response. The liver produces, you know, glucose in the very same way as we were talking about earlier when you're warming up for a workout, and you get a blood glucose response to a food because you're actually intolerant to it, when most doctors would say, oh, you have high blood sugar, you know, eat almonds as one of your staple foods because they're a low glycemic index food. There's so many variables that I think that the development of like an AI or automated platform to interpret and then self-quantify data and then prescribe exercise and health and lifestyle and dietary modifications based on that. There's just a long way to go still, but it's also exciting. You know, I think that
extremely is exciting. Extremely exciting. I have a vision of how it should evolve, but I'm looking for an entrepreneur who wants to do all the hard work where I can just give them the capital.
Yeah. Yeah. Word. Well, we've been going for a little while and I want to be respectful of your time, but if people want to kind of get inside your head and learn more about what you do or tune into your thoughts more, where's your most prolific platform? Would it be Twitter, Instagram, a website?
Yeah, I use Twitter, just at Raboy. I combine business advice, technology advice, startup advice, health and fitness activities, research I discover that I find interesting, readings I find. So that's probably the easiest way to track me.
Awesome. Cool. I'm going to have to go over there and follow you right now, because I just realized I don't think I actually follow you on Twitter. So to make that happen. Keith, thank you so much for coming on the show. For those of you listening in, again, like I took notes on everything Keith and I talked about in this discussion. I feel like I could have talked to you for another hour, but at this point, we'll call it a show. But I'm going to put all the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Keith for any of you who want to take a deeper dive. And you can also leave your comments, your questions, and your own feedback over there at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Keith. Keith, thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing all this with us, man. I love what you're up, your wealth of knowledge.
It's been a pleasure. I learned a lot. I'm going to have to follow up on a lot of your suggestions.
Yeah, no more bananas in the morning smoothie, I guess. But, anyway, and I'm sorry about that. And also, no more saying that 54 degrees is cold. Aside from that, all right. Well, Keith, I'll catch you later. And everybody else, thanks for listening in. I'm Ben Greenfield and Keith Raboy signing out from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Have an amazing week.
Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at BenGreenfieldFitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.